This meeting of the Crime Victims and Criminal Records Division will come to order. And it appears we do have a quorum, but first order of business, we'll approve the minutes. Representative Paymar moves to approve the minutes for all the minutes we have, which, would you just read off which ones we have? We have March 26, August 26, and September 26. Any review or nuanced changes? I don't hear of any. So all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. And thank you, Representative Paymar, for moving that. I also want to compliment you on your choice of jacket today. That looks particularly fantastic. I've never seen it before. Representative Hillstrom, are you ready to go with House File? Sorry, I don't have it in front of me. 2608.
Yes,
proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 2608 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Policy and Oversight Committee.
And that is the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill amends the Domestic Abuse Act to permit a court to include a reasonable area surrounding the dwelling or residence in an ex parte order for protection. And Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers for them to talk about what the bill is and why they need it.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. So please proceed in the order that you designated. And Representative Hillstrom, just make sure they sign in there as well.
And introduce yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Matthew Frank. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Attorney General's Office. House File 2608, Representative Hillstrom indicated, amends part of the ex parte order provisions of the Domestic Abuse Act. Under current Minnesota law, courts can exclude respondents in orders for protection from a reasonable area surrounding the dwelling or residence of the applicant for the order. This provision includes or adds that same language to the ex parte provision that an applicant can provide or apply for from the court. It in fact adds the exact same language that is included within the provisions allowing for the permanent order. And the basic reasoning behind this is that the ex parte order provides a certain level of protection immediately. And at a time when victims and applicants for these orders might be most vulnerable because of the reaction of the abuser to the application itself or the actions taken by the victim. So this allows the court to apply the same protections in the ex parte order, which it, by its very nature is a very temporary order until a full hearing, to that ex parte, to that time period when that victim is particularly vulnerable prior to the full hearing. And so that is why we believe this is an appropriate amendment to the statute, and we would urge its passing.
Thank you. Mr. Frank. Next, testifier. Oh, Representative Paymar had a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To the witness, just the, I mean, it would be the same with a permanent order, but what constitutes a reasonable area? Obviously, the judge is going to make that decision based on certain criteria they're getting from the victim and or the advocate, but how far does reasonable go?
Correct. And Representative Paymar, the bill also includes language instructing the court, telling the court that it must describe specifically in the order what reasonable area means. And that language is in the permanent order subdivision as well. And typically what courts do is define that in terms of geographic area within a block or two blocks or within 100 feet or in certain areas that the respondent would recognize. Typically the respondents know the area that's being defined because they've been involved with the person who lives or resides there. And so there are a number of different ways that they can do it, but a court must do that specifically. Initially, of course, the applicant will apply for a specific order and will describe that themselves, and the court then is free to be more specific or to change the wording that the applicant has used. So it can be defined in a number of ways, but the court is instructed to be very specific about that.
Any further questions for Mr. Frank? And Representative Hillstrom, your next testifier.
Yes, hello. My name is Vanessa Foster, and I'm a legal advocate for victims of domestic violence. I work for an agency called Tubman. I work in Minneapolis, but we serve Ramsey, Washington, and Hennepin counties. I'm here today because I know this change to the ex parte order for protection would have important real-world consequences for my clients. I have seen how important it is for the OFPs, which are enforced by local police, to be clear and consistent. Police officers can only act if an ex parte OFP specifically states it. Too often, abusers will stretch the limits of an OFP to intimidate, threaten, or harass their victims. This is the nature of domestic violence. Abusers want to maintain control and power over their victims, and they will push the limits of the law to maintain that control and power. OFPs are intended to protect victims of abuse by setting boundaries for abusers. Unfortunately, abusers have an inclination to either push these boundaries or disregard them altogether. During my years as an advocate, it has been my experience that an OFP has to be explicit and clear, or else abusers will take advantage of the system and continue to harass, intimidate, or threaten their victims. For a recent example, a client that our agency worked with had an ex parte OFP that restricted the abuser from her home address. To get around this restriction, the abuser loitered three doors down from the victim's home. The victim saw the abuser there and called the police, but when they came, they told her there was nothing they could do because the OFP only restricted the abuser from her dwelling and not a reasonable distance from the dwelling place. So legally, the abuser was not in violation of the OFP and the police could not arrest him. It was clear in this situation that the abuser was loitering around the neighborhood to intimidate the victim because the abuser had no reason to be there. The abuser did not know anyone who lived at that home three doors down. Unfortunately, there were no legal restrictions that prevented the abuser from loitering near the victim's home, her street, or even in her alley. The victim in this case was extremely afraid of the abuser and the fact that he was lingering near her home. The police could not protect her until he entered her home or threatened to actually hurt her. This is just one of the many cases we deal with. Our victims are living in fear. We need the passage of this bill to help keep them safe and to prevent their abusers from terrorizing them. Please pass this bill so that the ex parte OFP explicitly states a reasonable distance. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Foster. Are there questions for Ms. Foster? Seeing none, then do you have another testifier? Representative Hillstrom.
Good morning. Can you hear me? My name is Sandra, and I'm from St. Paul Intervention Project, and I'm here to share a little bit about, and I'm a legal advocate as well, about why it is important for our clients to not to be, not to have abusers around their houses, because I have in my experience where I have done many orders for protection where abusers, there's just one example where the abuser was outside of the house waiting for her and following her everywhere that she was going. She was intimidated by abuser and also will slash her tires and follow her. And I know that she was just in fear, but police couldn't do much about it because there was no restriction about him staying away from her neighborhood. And also, I think that it is important for clients to be protective and to pass this bill. And that's all.
Thank you. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Hillstrom. Are there any further questions for members of the division? Yes, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a question for Representative Hillstrom. You know, I'm not terribly familiar with the process of these, so when an order would be issued by a judge, what type of specificity would be included? So would reasonable be defined within a specific, you know, so many feet, so many miles? But what would be customary practice?
Representative Hillstrom or Mr. Frank.
Thank you. Yes, the judge can do that in any number of ways. The amendment does direct the court to be specific, to describe with specificity the reasonable area. That could be done in terms of a number of feet, 300 feet from the property or 500 feet or miles. It could be other geographic examples such as blocks, city blocks, could be the entire town, some rural areas, towns are much smaller, of course, and a user could be excluded from the entire town. So there are a number of ways in which the court could do that. That's really left to, with the ex parte application process, in the first instance, the applicant, and in the second instance, of course, the court in issuing the order itself. The court must be specific, and the court, of course, is free to draft that language to make it specific. But there are a number of ways that they could do that, yes. And that's true of the permanent order as well. That same language appears in the permanent order application or subdivision.
Thank you.
Representative Schimansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for this question. It's not quite on topic, but in an order for protection, is the, I don't know how you call it, the defendant, is he, are they permitted to return to the residents to claim property? And if there's a situation where they need things that are within the residence, will they have the benefit of retrieving their personal possessions so that they can maintain their life?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schimansky, typically it's just once, and it's with a police escort.
Okay.
Representative Schimansky.
Okay, I have another question. But in determining, this zone of protection, let's just presume that the residence in question, under the order for protection, is adjacent or near the defendant's other family members, parents, extended family, and so forth. Will that be taken into consideration?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schimansky, the judge can take any of those things into account. The judge will ultimately be making the decision. And really what we're trying to get at is when they don't have any reason to be in the area. If you're loitering three doors down and you don't know anyone who lives on the street, you don't know anybody else in the neighborhood, clearly your purpose for being there is to harass and terrorize. And so the judge will have all the flexibility they need in determining, where are they legitimately and where are they not.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should know this question or the answer to it, I suppose, but do we have sufficient legal advocacy? Tough Men and shelters around the metro area, but do we have sufficient advocacy to provide the victim with this information? And if not, does the court administrator explain each one of the reliefs to the victim who's coming in for an ex parte petition?
Representative Hillstrom or any of the testifiers?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to phone a friend.
You're allowed to do that in this committee, Representative Hillstrom.
I'm Liz Richards with the Minnesota.
Just take this.
I'm Liz Richards with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And in terms of the adequacy of resources, we don't have legal advocacy services that cover the entire state sufficient to represent every woman or every petitioner who comes in. But by law, the court clerk is required, the court is required to provide clerk services to anybody coming in because this is a pro se process. And so one of the reasons for putting this into the law, it will also, should be reflected then on the uniform forms. So rather than relying upon an advocate saying, you could make this request if you need it, see if, and talk people through it, it will be automatically in the law. It should be on the uniform forms as one of the potential checks. So if they need a reasonable distance exclusion, they can do that, and then the judge would be required to specify what that reasonable distance is when it's submitted for review.
Representative Paymar?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Richards. Are there any further questions from members of the division? Seeing none, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House... Oh, that's right. We do ask that. Thank you for the reminder. Is there any public testimony, other individuals in the audience who would like to be heard on House File 2608, either proponents or opponents of this measure? And I don't see any. Then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2608 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, members.
Representative Gardner, are you ready? The motion on this will likewise then be that House File 2864 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Division with Representative Hillstrom. As I understand it, there is an oral amendment that you have, though, Representative Gardner. Is that the case?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
By the way, I'm glad to see that you really dig my hairstyle.
I asked the Army barber to give me the Gardner special, Representative Gardner. And I was surprised he knew what that was down in Georgia, but he did.
Okay. Mr. Chair, after concerns raised by Representative Holberg on the issue of privacy, there was an amendment that I'd like to move, or I can't move it, but if someone could do this on line 1.20, between the word abuse and the word and, to insert a comma, and then the phrase to assure that electronic monitoring data are only used to protect victims.
Okay. I'll move that. Then Representative Olin moves that oral amendment as stated on the record. Is there, for the purpose of discussion, so that's up there, Representative Gardner, did you have any discussions or opposition to this oral amendment that you heard from after it was proposed by Representative Holberg?
Mr. Chair, I am not aware of any. I have not.
So long as it was innocuous, then Representative Gardner, please proceed with your testimony on the bill.
Very good.
I'm sorry. We moved it, so it needs to be passed. All in favor of the oral amendment in order to get the bill in the shape that Representative Gardner wishes it, all in favor of that stated amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. So to the bill as amended, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Domestic violence is not an issue that I had been worked on in the past, but two of the fatal domestic violence incidences that took place in Minnesota took place about 2 miles apart from each other in my district, about 90 days apart from each other. That's led to a lot of community dialogue about the issue of domestic violence, and we're looking for ways to address the issue. But I'd like to hand it over to the experts here who can explain the bill further, and so Liz Richards is here.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. And Ms. Richards.
Chairman Lesh, members of the committee, I'm Liz Richards with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And I'm here to testify in favor of House File 2864. What this bill does is it lifts the current restriction on electronic monitoring for as a pretrial condition on domestic abuse cases and authorizes pilot projects to try electronic monitoring with these domestic abuse offenders. One thing that the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women does is compile information on domestic violence homicides that occur in the state each year. And on February 9th, we released our 2009 femicide report, and you should each have a copy of this. And in 2009, there were 18 Minnesota adults who were murdered in domestic violence incidences. And already in 2010, there are at least an additional four murder victims. And the deaths of 2009 included the death of Officer Richard Crittenden, who was killed in September in North St. Paul. There were also at least three women who had active no-contact orders in place at the time of their murders. And we know that a number of the other cases, there was a known history of domestic violence and prior involvement with the criminal justice system. We know that key indicators of lethality were present in a significant number of these homicides. And as our criminal justice system becomes better at looking for and assessing for these lethality factors, electronic monitoring becomes one tool that can help in those cases to enhance safety. Stearns County has a domestic violence court, and their domestic violence court focuses on repeat offenders who have a current charge of a felony-level domestic assault. And during one three-month period last year, they had 19 domestic violence offenders in that domestic violence court program. From those 19 offenders during that three-month period of time, there were 401 violations of conditions of release. And a majority, the vast majority of those violations were violations of the no-contact provisions of their conditional of release. And it's precisely those offenders that this type of monitoring would be targeting. And so I was talking earlier this week with Stearns County Attorney Janelle Kendall, who is very instrumental and heads up that domestic violence court. And she said that if the ban on electronic monitor was lifted statutorily, that their domestic violence court would definitely consider a pilot project of electronic monitoring. She would see this as a useful additional tool, and it's these repeat offender violators that they would be looking at. But at the same time, electronic monitoring needs to have both dedicated resources and a localized system that really is capable of implementing it. And there are many questions that need to be answered as implementation goes forward, and a number of issues that need to be thought through. And not every jurisdiction in Minnesota is in a place and is capable of putting the system, a monitoring program, into place. And there are some potential risks as well. And I briefly outlined some information on electronic monitoring for each of you. You should have been given this when you came in, and has a very brief outline of some of those issues. So what is being proposed is that people can put together a pilot project that brings the right people to the table, discusses through some of these issues before they go forward. So I think I'll stop at this point and just sit for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I actually carried some of the first electronic monitoring provisions, and the reason there was a ban on using electronic monitors or that I worked on was because we didn't want judges to allow electronic monitoring at home when, in fact, the abuse is what was happening at home. And so I think that it's absolutely appropriate to use electronic monitoring to figure out about folks that are violating, provided we don't move into the realm of, instead of punishing, we let people do electronic monitoring at home when they're abusing at home. So I think this is a great idea and strongly supportive.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Paymar.
Chair, Mr. Richards, are you assuming that this will be, or would this be up to the county that decided to develop a pilot project? Are you assuming, and from the research, is this best for high-risk offenders, for all offenders? What kind of criteria would a judge use to make that determination, or is it too new to even describe?
Ms. Richards.
Thank you. Representative, these are the sort of bundle of questions that need to be looked at. And one of the places we've been in discussion is with the National Network to End Domestic Violence, which is a national organization. And one of their areas of expertise is around technology. And it's very clear, and there's a number of different kinds of electronic monitoring programs out there. And sort of depending on how you look at electronic monitoring, it has different capabilities. And depending on what your system's ability to respond to it, to both monitor and respond, makes a difference in terms of what should be set up. And based on some of those considerations, it would then would fill into whether it's a match with what kind of offender. And so one of the areas that I know in my discussions with Stearns County is that because defendants have an absolute constitutional right to bail, that they're actually looking at it at some of the highest risk offenders who are able to post high bails, but also have a history of violating the no contact orders while out on release as an additional level of both protection and advance warning to victims and a triggering to law enforcement. So it may be a fit for high risk offenders. It may not be, depending on the system and how they match it up with what they're currently doing.
And Mr. Chair, how much does the device cost, and how much does a typical program like this cost?
Ms. Richards.
Thank you. There's quite a variety in terms of the cost of the program, depending on how it's set up and what the monitoring is. What we're looking for here is not any state dollars to go with this. We're really authorizing programs to set up a pilot, which means the pilot would be responsible for figuring out whether they're either going to seek outside funding sources to pay for this or whether the system can currently absorb it within whatever they're doing, whether it's a shifting of dollars within their own system. But there would be no additional dollars set to this. Some systems will be built in where they look at the defendant pays for the per-day cost for monitoring. That's one of the things people need to look at as to how prohibitive that cost is.
Representative Mansfield. Oh, sorry, Representative Mansfield.
But do you know how much it costs? I mean, let's say, and I don't even know how long a judge would require someone to wear such a device. Let's say you wore it for 60 days. How much would that cost? Do you have a sense of?
Ms. Richards.
Thank you. I've heard a range, and this is not really my area of expertise, but in terms of what I hear, it can range anywhere from something like the $10 to $20 a day kind of range is what I've been hearing. I think it really depends on the system you've set up.
Thank you.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Richards, I was looking through the statistics in your booklet here, and I know some of the domestic violence cases are murder-suicide. Is there anything in this booklet that addresses the domestic issue of murder-suicide?
Ms. Richards.
Thank you. What we have in here is that if you'll note, I know what the figures are, that currently in the last year, 50% of the adult homicide cases also involved a suicide. I believe we made a slight switch in how we're doing the femicide report this year. This is sort of a scaled-down version, and the expanded version, which goes into some more detail around those facts, will be released June 1st. And so I'm not certain whether we actually reflect that in this report or if that's in the expanded version, to tell you the truth. But I know that 50% of the cases did involve suicide last year in Minnesota.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The purpose of this GPS system on the offender, is it meant as a deterrent to the offender, or is it a tracking device that if he gets near the victim, is law enforcement going to be triggered to respond?
Ms. Richards?
There are different systems in terms of how they set up. The primary purpose of the electronic monitoring is really a warning system. And the systems that are most highly recommended are systems that will both, there's an exclusionary zone set up. And once a defendant enters an exclusionary zone, typically there are two warnings that are sent out. One to the victims will have a companion device that then lets them know that the defendant has come into the exclusionary zone, and also typically a monitoring agent, which may be law enforcement, or maybe somebody else, is notified so that law enforcement can be dispatched because the person is in the zone. That may have a deterrent effect on no contact on that violating the no contact zone, but the primary focus is really on warning.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question. I'm not involved in the legal field or in any type of these cases, but when an offender is released on bail, is there any psychological evaluations done to determine the likelihood that they may be in at risk of further violence?
Ms. Richards?
I break that into two things. Whether or not there's a psychological assessment, that's really dependent on court resources. That's not the most typical things that happens at release. But what we do know is that there are some key lethality factors. And just at the end of December, the Minnesota State Supreme Court distributed to every judge, magistrate, and referee in the state a bench card which lists those lethality factors and with a recommendation that best practices would be to, when you have a domestic violence case in front of you, seek information on those lethality factors to help the judge in various determinations as to what would be appropriate for them. So in a criminal case, someone comes up on a bail, that if you have information on lethality factors in front of you as a judge, you can use that in fashioning appropriate conditions of release.
Representative Szymanski, last final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do the statistics that you've gathered here in Minnesota compare with other states, on a per capita basis? Are we on the low end of the scale of, domestic violence,
Ms. Richards?
I don't have the exact figures in here. What I can tell you is that we are neither on the low end or on the high end. Exactly where we fall across the states, I can't tell you that off the top of my head. I could certainly get that information for you if you needed it.
Thank you.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question is kind of a follow-up on Representative Shemansky's, but I was wondering if you have any data from the states who have implemented the electronic monitoring, that they've seen either a decrease in violation of the no-contact orders as a result, or perhaps even more importantly, a decrease in deaths or of violence occurring to the victims we're trying to protect.
Ms. Richards.
And what I can say is we've just started to look at other states as this has come up here in the last, 6 months. What I do know is the states that we've listed here, some of these, I believe three of the states have generalized electronic monitoring can be used on any kind of case, and they don't exclude domestic violence. A number of the more recent states that have come on board, they're specific to using electronic monitoring in the domestic violence context. And some of those states have gone forward without pilot projects. And what we've heard is that there's a lot of sort of a lot of problems and issues that they're still working through. They've come online with this in the last 3 years. And so there's not a really good sense of this. I know there have been some very limited studies done. I believe in the Boston area they had a study, but I believe it was 8 or 12 offenders that they looked at that were on electronic monitoring. So very small study. And they found there were no additional offenses while they were on electronic monitoring of those offenders. But they aren't extensive studies that have been done at this time. But the general view right now is that it looks like there is promise that the programs are set up well.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one last question. Is there any evidence or information from victims who, you know, if this system has been put in place against a defendant, that they feel more comfortable knowing that this system is there in place? Because it sounds to me like it's an early warning system for them. So the impetus will be on them to, I assume, either call the police or not to act in their own protection, if you will, for fear of something happening. Do they feel better having this? Is it providing some measure of comfort for them with the situation that they face? Or do you have any information on that?
Ms. Richards.
What I have is just anecdotal information at this point. What appears is in other states who have recently come on board with electronic monitoring, the impetus has really come from victims or from victims' families, victims who have been murdered. And the other piece that we know is that there are some victims who actually currently will go to the private expense of installing security systems to try and set this sort of level of security around themselves. There have been some cases here in the state of Minnesota. But this is one of the areas where I think that victims do feel an increased sense of security, and one of the things we want to make sure that happens in the pilot is that it's a true sense of security and not a false sense of security when it doesn't really exist.
Thank you.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Coming from a prosecutor, this may seem like a strange question since I have 32 years as a prosecutor, but I look at your advisory group and my immediate question comes up, would there be any value in having someone from the defense bar or somebody at least on that side of the issues on this advisory group?
Ms. Richards? Or Representative Gardner?
Well, here's, I guess, what I would say is that I think that it might be, depending on what your jurisdiction is, how it's functioning. And I don't see this as an exclusionary list. I think that that's why the judge of a judicial district is really appointing your advisory group under the statute. And I could believe that there are jurisdictions where it would be absolutely appropriate to have defense bar part of that advisory group.
Ripsola?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just it says consisting of, and it seems to be rather exclusionary. And like I said, it's a strange question coming from me, but I think you could have a whole lot of value having somebody from the defense bar in a lot of areas on this committee.
Thank you, Representative Olin. Are there any other questions from members of the committee? I would ask Ms. Richards, in the jurisdiction that you described, I believe it was St. Cloud, where you had 401 violations for 19 offenders over 3 months, I believe it was?
That's correct.
Oh,
how many of those 401 violations, if you know, were, say, jail phone calls that we recorded to the victim?
I don't have the exact figures in front of me. I could get them from the county attorney in Stearns County. We had a phone conversation. Many of those were phone conversations from jail, but there were also a number of out of various levels of contact. They aren't all assaults, but contact violations of the no contact order is primarily a large portion of those violations, and that would include contact from the jail as well as once upon release coming to the property, making contact once out of jail as well. I'm not sure exactly what the breakdown is on those contact violations.
And I know that's a specific question, Ms. Richards, but the reason I ask is from my experience, I've gotten a lot of people on that, and I'd be willing to bet it's the plurality of violations that you see, because some of these guys just continually call when the recording says this is being recorded for the purposes of law enforcement, and they still call their girlfriend and get pinched for that. So I'm always appreciative when violators self-monitor that way, and we can pinch them for that. My second question relates to this, as I see it, is very similar to what we do in cases of DWI. If you have a second-degree DWI or you blow an intoxilizer in excess of .20, it's mandatory maximum bail of $12,000 under Minnesota law. If you can't pay that, and most people don't have 12 grand sitting in their bank account to pay it when they get a DWI, you can do the alcohol monitoring program, which costs about $12 a day, and they pay for pretrial release to obtain that. Was this in any way seen as an effort to mirror that effort, which is seen as a reasonable restriction to maintain public safety?
It wasn't necessarily looking to parallel that program. It may well be that the same type of setup happens, but really what we're saying is there's currently this restriction in law, so people haven't really looked at domestic violence cases and pretrial monitoring, and so it's really lifting that restriction to say, start looking at this, you know, and if depending on what your resources are within your jurisdiction, and if you think that this is a fit, start asking those questions, looking around, getting information, seeing if you can set up a pilot that makes sense. And it may well be that it's a mirror to what's going on in DUI monitoring.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. No. Representative Owen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as I was on the subject, I would like to indent a short amendment. After the word prosecutors, put comma, defense attorneys, comma, court, and
go on. Would you identify the line, Representative Olin?
1.18.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, did you have a particular place you wanted to insert that? Was it after prosecutors, I think?
After prosecutors, and then before court administrators.
And the language you had was defense attorneys?
Representative Olin.
Mr. Chair, yes, Mr. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I would certainly accept that as a friendly amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gardner. Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted some clarification. I'm strongly supportive of what Representative Olin is doing. I just want to know if it's defense attorneys or if it's public defenders.
Representative Olin.
I'm sorry, I missed it.
Representative Olin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I use the word defense attorneys because there may be a case they want to use defense, but they certainly could use public defenders, and I'm expecting in most cases they would.
Okay. Thank you. Then, Representative Schimansky.
This probably isn't the appropriate time we can work on this amendment, but the other question I have is the other advocates in here are battered women's organizations, and so my question is, what about the men's organizations, if we're amending this as well?
Does anyone want to feel that? Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schimansky, I don't believe there's any specific organizations that would be identified as a male victims organization that is funded by the Office of Justice Programs in the state of Minnesota. Some battered women's programs are specifically articulated in statute, but battered women's programs also have a responsibility to provide services regardless of gender. So if a man was to come in, they wouldn't necessarily be able to stay at a shelter, for instance, but the most programs would have the ability to get them housing if they needed safety, or to assist them with an order for protection. But this is the language that's in statute, so you'd have to change the whole entire statute. And I don't know, is that in?
Thank you, Representative Paymar. And as of yet, I don't think the batterers have organized yet either, which would exclude them. As to the amendment, then, on line 1.18, after prosecutors, comma, would be inserted the words defense attorneys, comma. All in favor of the oral amendment as stated, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar.
I don't want to do it here, on line 120, the amendment that Representative Gardner put in there, I think someone's going to need to fix the language there. It doesn't quite work. But
okay, well,
we can do that on the way.
Let's do that in Representative Hillstrom's committee. Then the bill 2860, Representative Olin's motion? Mm-hmm. Representative Olin renews his motion that House File 2864 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. All in favor of motion as stated, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There being no other business before the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shemaski.
I'd just like to make a little presentation to the chair of the Crime Victims and Criminal Records as a memorial to his deployment to the Red Bulls. And so we present you with this token of our appreciation.
Thank you very much. For the record, they didn't let us drink this down there. We got watery Gatorade, and that's it. So this will taste much better. Thank you very much, Representative Shemaski.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Division is adjourned.